Dive into our passage then. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 19. We have weeks like last week where we didn't have Sunday evening service, and it just makes it feel like it's been forever since we've been in our passage. I mean, it feels like it's been at least 2 weeks since we've been in here. I know, I'm full of bad jokes tonight. All right? Full of bad jokes, so. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 19, approaching the end of David's life. Just to refresh our understanding of the timeline, we are looking at somewhere, David is between 60 and 65 years old at this point, probably approaching the 65 mark. We have a few events in his life that have to take a few years. But we're looking at David somewhere around there. Of course, he only lived to 70 years old, so we are approaching the last few years of David's life. The episode with Absalom stretched on for close to a decade, maybe just a little bit over that, from the time that his brother Amnon raped his sister Tamar until the time that Absalom was killed in the Battle of Ephraim. We've got about a dozen years or so. So we're covering a lot of ground at one time here, but Absalom's rebellion has been put down, and where we pick up here in chapter 19 is after Joab has to rebuke David for his excessive grief, and as we said last time, I can't find the pointer anywhere. Where is it? Start moving. I need to be able to point. And it's nowhere to be found. And my computer's locked up. That's why it's nowhere to be found. Let me see the clicker there. We'll do it this way. Because I'm pretty sure everything we need to see tonight is up there, so we're just going to leave this computer confused. And we'll let it stay that way. Maybe it'll figure itself out. So where's the... Which one is the laser button?
It's the one with the red line.
And it's not turned on. There we go. Because it's not on. All right, it's on now. Okay. So, David had fled to Mahanaim up here in the highlands of Gilead. So we said, this is a big plateau area. Lots of good ground for grazing cattle, things like that. But as you hit this dark line, you're starting to descend into the Jordan River Valley, somewhere around a 3,000-foot drop within just a few miles. Very steep hills, very steep ravines, a pretty treacherous place. But then you have the Jordan River Valley, which is some 20 miles across, that's pretty broad, very fertile ground down there, because at this point the Jordan River overflows its banks every season. It's sort of like the Nile River, which makes the ground very fertile, but makes your flood insurance extremely expensive. And so the Battle of Ephraim started up here north of Mahanaim and then raged across the Jordan River Valley into the forests of Ephraim over here, where Absalom was killed by Joab and his body was buried. When news reached David that Absalom was dead, he was so stricken with grief that he put his entire army into a state of despair, because he couldn't recognize that it really was a victory that the Lord gave him. Absalom's defeat was a judgment of God. And so as a father, as a parent, we can understand his grief. None of us would want to see that happen to our children. But as the king, he's also got responsibility towards his people. And the comment that the chronicler makes for us, or the writer of 2 Samuel makes for us, is that the people stole into the city as people that steal in after a defeat. So even though they won the victory that day, because of David's response, they acted like, or they came to think of the day as a huge defeat. Well, some time has passed since then, as we pick up in the middle of verse 8, actually, where it says, "Now Israel had fled, every man to his own tent." This is one of those great times where we realize that the verse divisions and chapter divisions in our Bible are not part of the inspired text, right? Those were added later, and they didn't always get it quite right. Because right there in the middle of verse 8, what's that three-letter word that starts the sentence? Now, that is a marker that tells you we are changing topics a little bit, because before that we've been talking about David and his grief. Now we're going to talk about a new subject, which is the people of Israel. So we're returning to another topic. So there's this section division right there in the middle of verse 8. And probably most of your Bibles have some sort of marker right there that tells you a paragraph division or something. And so you know that, but it is there in the middle of verse 8. Now Israel had fled, every man to his own home. Why do you think they all fled? Probably not these guys, because the guys that were on David's side all went to Mahanaim. This is all Israel. This is the rest of them. Why do you think they fled? Yeah, now they're afraid of David. They've lost. Their leader is dead. Absalom's gone. And so now they've all gone back home, and they just kind of sit there and twiddle their thumbs and hope the whole thing passes over, right? And maybe David won't check the rosters of the army that gathered against him when he comes back into power. Well, all the people, verse 9, were arguing throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?" So here's this dispute going out throughout Israel. So you can imagine it at all the coffee shops and Ziggy-like places throughout northern Israel, that the discussions are, boy, what do we do about David? Do we ask him to come back? He's probably not very happy with us after what we did, but who else are we going to turn to? I mean, he actually is the rightful king. Now that you have time to ponder, oh, we sided with the wrong guy. Well, you know, maybe we should go back and ask David. So there's this national debate going on. This also tells us that some time is passing. Excuse me. We're not talking the order of years here, but we are talking the order of probably weeks and maybe some months are passing as Israel debates about what they should do with this scenario. David is still hiding here in Mahanaim, but all of Israel is debating. What should we do? Do we ask David to come back? Do we want to install him? I mean, after all, he was the guy that defeated the Philistines for us. Look at all the protection he gave us. I mean, Israel rose to a height of power it had never seen under David. He strengthened their military. They were economically prosperous. The only time Israel's ever going to see anything similar is under David's son Solomon, but nobody knows that yet. And so they're debating, should we bring David back? This news reaches David. So verse 11, King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. "Say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring back the king to his house, when the word of all Israel has come to the king? You are my brothers, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king?" See, here's the problem. With all this news reaching David that there's a national debate in Israel, you have to remember that very often throughout the Old Testament, when you read the word Israel, it's talking about the northern kingdoms. If it wants to reference Judah, it'll call it Judah. If it wants to reference all Israel, it might call it Israel, but it'll generally make some distinction that they're talking about both. There was, throughout the existence of Israel, a huge division between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. It existed even all the way back into the period of the judges. For some reason, there was just an animosity between the northern tribes and Judah, right? And it evidences itself all the time. So he hears from Israel, the northern tribes, that they're ready to welcome him back as king. But he hasn't heard anything from Judah. Why is that a problem? Not just born in Judah. He is Judah. David is a Judean. He's descended from Judah. And so his own family hasn't yet sent to him and said, "Hey, come on back." And so he's sending them this message saying, "Come on, guys. You know, hurry up, let's get on the ball here, hold your elections and get things done. You should be the first ones welcoming me back." But they haven't. So he sends them this little encouragement. Why should you be the last ones to bring back the king? So that little bit of encouragement to try and get Judah moving to welcome him back as king, that's what he's been waiting for. It's why he hasn't marched back, because most of Israel, including Judah, was with Absalom heart and soul. And so he doesn't want to just march back to Jerusalem and take things over and impose himself. He really needs to know that the people are with him again. And so he's waiting for that signal. So when he starts hearing these rumors, well, you know, they're talking about it in Israel, but Judah hasn't said anything. That's when he sends his messengers down. Now he's got another message to deliver, which is an interesting one in verse 13. Say to Amasa, does anybody remember who Amasa is?
Is he the guy that was cursing when David and burned
God's sin? Nope. The fellow that was cursing David, his name was Shimei, the Benjaminite. Amasa. Not yet. Yep. Amasa was the general of Absalom's armies. Amasa is a relative of both Joab and David. They're all David's father's family. All right. So Joab is a cousin. Amasa is just a little bit distant cousin. Here's the message he has for Amasa. Remember, Amasa was the enemy general. Are you not bone, or are you not my bone and my flesh? Remember, because they're family. God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. Anybody else find this an interesting statement? Why might David be interested in replacing Joab? Didn't Joab just win a major victory? Hasn't Joab always won major victories? He probably found out what Joab did. And what did Joab do? Joab killed his son. Yeah. Remember, Absalom was hanging from the oak tree by his hair, completely defenseless. At that point, the war is over. Your enemy's ability to make war has been crushed, and you take him prisoner. Okay, especially since David had given command to all of his generals, deal gently with the young man Absalom for my sake. But Joab didn't. Any other events in Joab's life that David might be commenting upon in replacing him? Can't remember his name? Yeah, there was another guy that David wanted to replace Joab with. It was the leader of Ishbosheth's army. And don't feel bad, Tim. His name is escaping me at the moment, too. But, all right. The general of Ishbosheth's army, remember Saul's son, Ishbosheth? David sent and was going to make that man general as well. And what did Joab do about it? He killed him. He murdered him in cold blood. But there was no way to prove it. So David has been sort of plagued by Joab's hot temper all the way through his career as king. And so now he sees an opportunity to put Amasa in that position. I think this is a double-sided thing. David wants to replace Joab because Joab is so hot-tempered and because he's such a problem kind of guy, right? But I think he also needs a way to unify Israel with himself. And so what better way than to pick Israel's general, right? It's kind of like when our presidential candidates know that they're weak in one area of the electorate, and so they pick somebody that appeals to them. Okay, remember back a few years, John McCain recognized he was severely weak when it came to the real conservatives in the country, and so who did he pick to try and bolster that? Sarah Palin. And the whole idea behind that is, well, you know, we're not real strong with these conservative types, so let's have Sarah Palin be my running mate. She's really conservative. That'll get the conservative Christians on board. Okay. And really, Donald Trump has done the same thing here with picking Pence, because he needs that area of the electorate to win the election. Well, David's doing something similar here. In making Amasa his general, he's trying to appeal to the nation of Israel, for whom Amasa commanded the armies. And so he's trying to unite everything again. But he doesn't ask him. He simply swears this oath, God do so to me and more also. Now, you have to imagine this isn't the exact motion that they would have used. How many of you like motions with your songs? Aren't they fun? Yeah. Okay. Well, if you're going to be a very expressive 10th century BC Hebrew, you have to get the expression down too. But you have to imagine David saying, God, do so to me and more also. So the effect is God, strike me down. May the Lord strike me down if I don't make you commander in place of Joab. So David's calling down this oath upon himself to make Amasa the general. So it's making it very secure. He's not talking behind closed doors. He's not trying to insinuate. It always cracks me up when presidents are looking for vice presidential candidates. They never want to come right out and ask anybody, do they? Because it might be a slight. What if that guy doesn't want to and we have to ask him? Then the media will say he's our second choice and we can't do that, so we kind of have to... So, Jerry, you know, what would happen if, I don't know, hypothetically speaking, somebody might possibly ask you to run as vice president? You know, would that be something you're interested in? Not saying it's happening, right? And so they try to be all sly and sneaky about it, but David's not doing that. He just flat out swears an oath, Jerry, you're the guy. I'm making you him. And may God strike me down if I don't do it. So, word of this is probably going to get back to Joab, don't you think? How do you think Joab might respond to this? Anybody know the end of the story, by the way? I'm hinting at it. Okay. How do you think Joab's going to respond to this? Is he going to step down gently? Probably not. Okay, we'll get there. Probably not. So, David is trying to reunite the tribes around him, so he offers, it does not offer Amasa this position, he's just appointing him. But look at the result of it in verse 14. And he swayed the heart of all the men of Judah as one man. I don't know, do you really want to put your faith in such fickle people? I mean, they're for Judah, or they're for Absalom, they're for David, now they're back to David, I'm getting that mixed up. They were for David before, and then they're for Absalom, and now they're back to David. These people are all over the place. But they're decided again. Oh, yes, we want David back. And so they send word to the king. Return, both you and all your servants. Short message. Verse 16, so the king came back to Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over the Jordan. So here's the path we have to take. You're coming down from Mahanaim, and you would travel a road down here and then descend into the Jordan River Valley, just about across from Gilgal and Jericho. But right here, you have to cross this river. Now, the Jordan River is not a huge river, but it is a very deep river. It's not easy to cross. You remember the account of the crossing with Joshua, right? And so when God calls the Levites who are carrying the ark and says, as soon as your feet touch the waters of the river, it'll dry up, right? The Jordan River is not this big, wide, shallow river. It's a very deep river. And so you put one foot in, if that water doesn't dry up, you're in over your head. So God's really calling the Levites to this step of faith here. As soon as you put your foot in that river, it's going to dry up, and you're standing there saying, well, okay, because not only am I going to step into this deep river, but I'm also carrying this very heavy piece of equipment called the Ark of the Covenant. So anyway, they descend here. They're going to cross the Jordan River down there by Jericho. And Judah sends out this huge delegation of people. So Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over the Jordan. It's this big parade procession of people welcoming him home. Welcoming him back to Jerusalem. But so we have the homecoming is in order, and the promotions, as we looked at the title of the sermon tonight, was homecomings, promotions, and pardons. Well, now we got to deal with pardons. There were several people that were quite happy to see David go. And now he's coming back. Right? That might create a problem. And so they're going to try and fix this problem. So, Timothy, first guy we're going to run into, the one you mentioned, verse 16. Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite from Bahurim, hurried to come down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Now, Shimei is from what tribe? Benjamin. Who's the major tribe going down to meet David? Judah. Why do you think Shimei hurries to get down there with Judah? What's that? Yes, so it looks like he's an ally. I think Shimei knows he's got some groveling to do. You guys remember what Shimei did, right? Shimei was the one that was throwing stones at David as he left Jerusalem and cursing him and saying, "You're a bloody man and God's brought down judgment upon you for all that you did against the house of Saul," right? So this is the guy that David was walking by. He's throwing stones and cursing, and Joab and Joab's brother Abishai wanted to kill him. They said, "Let me get over there and I'll pin the guy to the ground with my sword, or I'll take his head off." All right. They wanted to kill him. And David said, "No, no, just let him curse. If the Lord wants to bring me back, the Lord will bring me back." Well, now the Lord's bringing him back, and who shows up with Judah but Shimei? And he's not alone. Look at verse 17. "And with him were 1,000 men from Benjamin." 1,000 men. So not only does Ziba go down there, but he's got the entire tribe of Benjamin just about convinced, we better get down there or we're in trouble. All right, we need to start pledging some oaths of loyalty to David right now, or this could go really badly for us. Because we were in awful good mood when he left, and he might not take too kindly to that now that he's coming back. So there's somebody else coming with this crowd of people. And that's in the middle of verse 17, Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, with his 15 sons and his 20 servants, rushed down to the Jordan before the king. Anybody remember Ziba? Go ahead. Yes, Mephibosheths. Yeah. Right. So, well, Mephibosheth is, yep, and we're going to deal with that in just a second. Turn back to, where'd it go? Oh, yeah, chapter 16, verse 1. If you'll remember back, because I know you all remember the title of every one of my sermons, right? I don't remember what I said last week, so don't worry if you don't, okay? The title of that sermon was Deceitful Servants, Cursing Opponents, and Disgraceful Sons. And we talked about a deceitful servant because Ziba shows up. But we said, you don't know that he's being deceitful yet. And we still don't, but we're going to find out. Chapter 16, verse 1, "When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins." Verse 2, "And the king said to Ziba, 'Why have you brought these?' And Ziba answered, 'The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. The bread and the summer fruit are for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink.' And the king said," here's the glaring question on David's mind, "'where's your master's son?'" In other words, Mephibosheth. Because remember, for the last 20 years or so, Mephibosheth has been eating at David's table as one of David's sons because of the oath that David made with Jonathan. All right? And so where is Mephibosheth? And here's what David says. "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Ooh, Mephibosheth's betrayed you, David. How do you like that? Well, here's how David likes that. Verse 4, "Then the king said to Ziba, 'Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. All that land you've been working with your sons for your master, I'm giving it to you.'" Now, we talked about that then, said David doesn't have the authority under God's law to transfer land. Okay? There was no such thing as eminent domain in God's kingdom. God gave the land. God apportioned it by lot to the different families when Israel entered the land, and nobody had the right to take it, not even the king. So David's acting outside of his authority. Real quick, Hannah, what do we call that in constitutional law? Very good. Ultra vires. There's a fun word you can impress your friends with. When the government acts outside of constitutional authority, it's called ultra vires, which is Latin for above authority. You're acting outside your authority. David did that in giving Ziba the land. So now, however long David has been gone, Ziba probably very quickly went home and said, "Ha ha ha, Mephibosheth, check it out. Here's the paper. It all belongs to me now." Right? So we're going to see how things go then. So jump back to chapter 19, where we left off. So here's Ziba. He comes with his 15 sons, his 20 servants. And everybody, this entire procession, verse 18, to cross the ford to bring over the king's household and to do his pleasure. So they, they cross over the river to the eastern side, and they're going to accompany David back. It's just, it's a parade, right? It's a position of honor. So first person to speak to the king, Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. That's as the king was about to cross the Jordan, right? Because Shimei is already across. Probably barely touched the water as he ran across that river trying to get to David, right? Falls down in front of him, and here's what he says. Let not my lord hold me guilty or remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. Do not let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to come down to meet my lord the king. David, did you notice I'm the first one to welcome you back? It's so good to have you here. Yeah, I was just kidding. All that rock throwing, all that cursing, yeah, I didn't really mean it. Right? He's begging for his life because he knows David's going to have every right to have him executed on the spot. And so he comes back. He makes sure he's the first one in line to welcome David home. Try to win him over just a little bit, okay? So, verse 21, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, this is Joab's brother. Remember, these guys are not to be trifled with. You don't want to get on their bad side. Well, Abishai says, shall not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Answer, should he be, shouldn't he be? Yeah, probably not. Probably not. I mean, it was a pretty treasonous act. David would have a case against him, but if he's going to be put to death, what has to happen? Two witnesses and a trial. Okay, you don't just execute people in Israel. God's law is pretty specific on that. You've got to have the witnesses, so it needs to happen. Well, David recognizes that, and verse 22 responds, but David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? I think I might be reading into the text, and I hope I'm not, because you never want to read into the text something that's not there, but do you hear David a little terse and short with the sons of Zeruiah? I think he's probably still, he's embittered against these two guys for all that they've done against him throughout his life. And he's probably getting tired of this violent rage that they keep throwing at everybody. And so that phrasing, what have I to do with you, really means I got nothing in common with you. What you're thinking right now is so far from what I'm thinking that it just doesn't even make sense. It's like the Pinky and Brain comics, cartoons. And so the Brain, the really smart mouse, would say, Pinky, are you pondering what I'm pondering? And Pinky would say something like, I think so, Brain, but if our knees bent backwards, how would we build a bicycle? Or how would we ride a bicycle? It was always just crazy stuff, like, where did that come from? So David's saying that to Abishai. He said, where does this come from? Where is this rage you guys have? No, I'm not going to execute anybody today. He says, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be as an adversary to me? Now, why else might David not be anxious to start executing people? He's coming back to Jerusalem. All of Judah's come down to meet him. All of Benjamin's come down to meet him. Why might David not be in a hurry to kill anybody? Go ahead, Gene. Yeah, it'd make him look bad. It'd make him look like a vindictive leader, wouldn't it? So what do you want to look like, a vindictive leader or a gracious leader? He said, you won the battle, you're coming back home. Is this the time to start cutting people's heads off? Well, David recognizes that. This is a time for mercy. And so he's going to extend that. And so he says, you know, Abishai, you guys are being an adversary. You're going to make me look bad if we go start cutting people's heads off because they were cursing and throwing rocks at me. Should anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For do I not know that I am this day king over Israel? Basically saying, we won. What do I have to worry about him for? We won the battle. We won the hearts of the people back. We're going back to Jerusalem. That's the end of it. Unfortunately, it's not quite the end of it. If you jump ahead, A few chapters into the book of 2 Kings, David is on his deathbed and he's giving instructions to Solomon. And guess what one of the things he tells him is? You remember Shimei, how he cursed me. Don't let his hairs fall to the ground in peace. And David holds a grudge against this man, even though he pardons him publicly, because look, he swears an oath. King said to Shimei, you shall not die, and the king gave him his oath. So David, now for the rest of his life, he can't touch him, at least not for that. But when he's dying, he tells his son Solomon, so you take care of Shimei, you'll know how to handle him. And eventually he does. Solomon finds a way to convict Shimei of a crime and puts him to death. And so David's talking about mercy here. He's talking about benevolent victory, but he's not going to live it out as much. And one of the things that we keep seeing out of David as he's getting towards the end of his life is that his commitment to doing what God says is wavering. Now, we can give him a little bit of understanding, because put in the same circumstances, I think we probably all might be making a few mistakes too. Have you ever been in a super stressful situation and your thinking just goes nuts and you're trying to make decisions, but it's tough, right? And so we can sort of understand where David's at. We can empathize with him a little bit, but that doesn't mean you can condone the actions that he's taking here. Eldon, was that a hand up?
No.
Okay, sorry. I thought I saw a hand going. He's just swatting at flies. So. All right. So verse 24. Now is where we're going to uncover the deception that we looked at back in chapter 16 with a deceptive servant or deceitful servants, because guess who comes down? Mephibosheth, David's loyal, adopted almost son. The grandson of Saul, related to Jonathan. He's going to be showing favor to him because of David's oath to Jonathan. And this is the guy that Ziba said, oh, he thinks this is going to be an opportunity to gain the kingdom back. So he stayed in Jerusalem. And so David left Jerusalem thinking that Mephibosheth had betrayed him. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. Why do you suppose he did that? He loves David. This guy's loyal to David. And so the whole time that David is exiled from his home, he's displaying his grief in a way that everybody around him couldn't miss. Now, we are probably talking months here that David has been gone now. So he hasn't cut his hair. He hasn't trimmed his beard. He hasn't bathed or washed his clothes. Now, don't read 20th century mentality back into this, because we tend to bathe like every day, every other day. We try to keep ourselves pretty clean, right? They didn't. You know, the bath would have been a much less frequent thing. They would have doused themselves in perfume to keep themselves smelling a little better. But Mephibosheth hasn't even been doing that. And so everybody that he walks by, there's an odoriferous emanation coming from him that says, this guy's in severe mourning. And so it would have been evident to David as soon as Mephibosheth came up, said, oh boy, he was serious. Whatever he was doing, he was serious about it. Gene? Yeah. Similar idea, yes. Yep. And the picture is, as long as you are exiled, I'm going to act like I don't have a home either. So I'm not bathing. I'm not living in comfort. I'm not trimming my beard. Okay. And so all of those things, signs, visible signs of anguish. And so when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? Hear a little bit of David's broken heart here. Why didn't you come with me? But he's giving him a chance to defend himself. In verse 26, he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, I'll saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king, for your servant is lame. So the picture here is that Mephibosheth gave orders to Ziba, go saddle a donkey, I'm leaving with David. And so he sits and he waits, and he waits, and he waits, and he waits, and Ziba never comes back in and says, master, the donkey's saddled, you're all ready to go. Why not? Because Ziba got on the donkey himself and went to go to David. So he was tricked. Mephibosheth was tricked by Ziba. All right. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like an angel of God. Oh, that what a rebuke. Because that phrase, my lord the king is like an angel of God, that means you see things clearly. You see things as they really are. There's no way he tricked you. And what's David thinking? Yeah. Yeah, he didn't slip anything by me, did he? Yeah, he did. David knows that. He knows he got duped by this guy. Do therefore what seems good to you, for all my father's house were but doomed to death before my lord the king, but you set your servant among those who ate at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? I mean, look at this guy's contentment with grace. He understands his position is one of depending completely upon David's benevolence. Because he says, you know, my father's family, we were dead. You restored us. You're the one that lifted us back up. So I don't even care about the land. Because I know I've got a position with you, David. And so he's endearing himself to David there. He's throwing himself upon David's grace, even while recognizing what David did in transferring the land was wrong. Well, David's going to have a little bit of a problem here because he swore an oath to Ziba, you can have the land, it's all yours. Now what do? You swore an oath in front of everybody that Ziba could have that land, and now you find out Ziba was tricking you. Well, the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided. Here's the judgment he renders. You and Ziba shall divide the land. From now on out, it belongs to both of you. You guys split it. Okay? You're both sharing the profits of the land. Once again, David's overstepping his bounds. He doesn't have authority to do this. That land belongs to the family that God gave it to. And so how he comes in here thinking that he's going to be able to make this decision. Once again, we can empathize with him a little bit. He's been under some pretty stressful circumstances in the last few months, but it doesn't make his decision okay. But he's probably trying to save some face in front of all the Benjaminites that are there, because David knows that in a certain sense, his hold on the kingdom's hanging by a thread. They all rallied to Absalom pretty quickly. Yes, they're calling him back, but what's to stop them from going to somebody else again? In fact, they're going to. Here in just a little bit, they're going to go after somebody else again. So David knows his hold on the kingdom is thin. And so he doesn't want to upset the Benjaminites that are there. Remember, there's 1,000 of them gathered around. You don't want to upset that many Benjaminites and have them going back and reporting to the New York Times things like this. We call it the Jerusalem Times, I guess, right? So he says, you can divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all since my lord the king has come safely home. So who comes out of this looking better? Yeah, Mephibosheth comes off looking gracious beyond belief. Just let him, I don't even care about the land. David, I love you. I wanted you to come home safe. The land means nothing to me. And that was his whole statement about my family were as doomed men when you lifted us up. He says, I sit at your table, David. What do I need the land for? I don't need it for anything. And so Mephibosheth comes out of this looking very, very gracious. David comes off looking a little bit wishy-washy and having been deceived. Well, there's somebody else with David. Verse 31, now Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogalim. If we don't remember that name, he was mentioned before because when David got to Mahanaim, Barzillai the Gileadite came with a tremendous amount of provisions and men. Barzillai the Gileadite is extremely wealthy, and so he has supported David throughout his exile in Mahanaim. So he's coming with David down to the Jordan River in order to escort David home, just as a nicety. So he came down from Rogalim, and he went on with the king to the Jordan to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He had provided the king with food while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And the king said to Barzillai, come over with me, and I will provide for you with me in Jerusalem. This would be a very kingly thing to do. The people that helped you, you repay them. You give them favors, you give them special treatment. Okay, it hasn't changed. The politicians did it back then, they do it now. The people that help you get into power and office get rewarded. And so it was considered a very good thing for the king to try to repay the kindness that Barzillai had shown him during his exile. But Barzillai said to the king, "How many years have I still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm 80 years old." All right, if you're approaching 80 years old, don't take any offense over this, okay? What's that, Arlene? You're already so. Barzillai's got a great outlook on life, doesn't he? He's like, "I'm 80. I'm practically dead anyhow. So what's the point?" Listen to some of the other descriptives he gives there. And I was going to say you can tell us if they're true, but I won't ask that. All right. "How many years have I still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm this day 80 years old. Can I discern what is pleasant, what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? Can I listen to the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king?" He's basically, he's, "I got nothing to live for. Why would I go up to Jerusalem? I'm just about dead. I can't taste anything. I can't hear anything. I can't see anything." Right? And we know that's not the case, is it, Arlene? No, still full of pep, aren't you? You can still see. Yeah. I sound more and more like my grandparents. Walk into the room, look at the kids reading books in the pitch black, it seems like. Say, "Don't you want a light on?" Click, click. "No, I'm fine." Yeah. So anyway, Barzillai basically is politely turning down the king. There's no need for me to go to Jerusalem with you. I don't need that right now. He's got a different wish, though, in verse 36. "Your servant will go a little way over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king repay me with such a reward? Let your servant return, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Chimham. Let him go over with my lord the king and do for him whatever seems good to you." So I'm sending a surrogate, David. Yeah, you don't need to bless me with anything. I'm going to go home and die, and I'm going to be buried in my family grave. That's the best thing I've got to hope for right now. And so here, take my servant. Probably this is one of Barzillai's sons. And so he says, "Take him into your service and treat him well for my sake." And so the king answered, "Chimham shall go over with me, and I will do for him whatever seems good to you. And all that you desire of me, I will do for you." This is David repaying with kingly gifts the kindness of Barzillai. Verse 39, "Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king went over. And the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own home. Then the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah and half the people of Israel brought the king on his way." This is a big parade. I mean, you're talking tens of thousands of people marching with David as they come down to the Jordan River, and now they're marching up to Gilgal, and then they'll work their way southwest towards Jerusalem as David comes home. So, David's on his way back. We finish up right there. Verse 41 brings us a new section. All right. And so we'll start looking at those next week. Anybody have any questions?